Lowe's knows when you're looking for reliability, the right brand makes all the difference. And now, Lowe's is the exclusive home improvement retailer for the Whirlpool water treatment line, including their Wi-Fi softener, under-sink filtration system, and more. With Whirlpool's proven performance and our everyday low prices, better tasting, better quality water is within reach. Shop pro-trusted brands like Whirlpool and more, in-store or online. Lowe's. We help, you save.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Okay. Before I start, I'll just going to let you know, it was about 10 minutes ago we finished digging up the marrow, so it was cool to see you in that.
Oh my God, you finished digging up the what?
The marrow.
I forgot
the guy's name. The one with Ray Wise.
The one with Ray Wise. You're talking about Twisted Tales. Is that it?
Oh, no. It was. I forgot. I've instantly gone blank. But the director from who made Frozen and the Hatchet movies.
Oh, it's okay. Kind of a
mockumentary. And you showed up at one point and said, "Oh, you don't really believe that bullshit, do you?"
Well, that was Adam Green. Adam Green gave me the joke and said, "Would you mind doing this?" And Adam Green and Joe Lynch. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh God. And okay, Ray Wise is a lovely guy too, and a terrific actor. Yeah.
He always seems to be a really nice guy when I see him in interviews, and he plays the most intense characters.
Yes. Enjoy scaring the hell out of you.
Yeah. Okay, so, right, 3, 2. Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of Silver Screen's Cult Classics. I'm DK, and we've got a rare treat for you listeners today, as I'm speaking to a legend in the movie business. He's an actor, screenwriter, author, and director, with such classics under his belt as Psycho 2, Cloak and Dagger, Child's Play, and Fright Night. He's also a personal hero of mine, so allow me to say a big welcome to Mr. Tom Holland.
Big welcome back, everybody.
Thank you, sir. How are you today? Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for asking me. How am I? I'm here. I don't know. I feel buried by there's so much going on, you know, and I'm trying to, you know, I'm getting the word out on the Child's Play book, so I'm doing more podcasts and interviews than I normally do, and trying to schedule it all and write at the same time. Not easy.
Well,
I'll
make sure we get a link direct to the Child's Play book on, so when it goes up live, people can click straight through.
It is up live. It's on Amazon and it's on terrortime.shop.
Fantastic. Well, God. As I say, thank you for taking the time out to talk to us here on the show. So I'm going to get straight into it. What first inspired you to become involved in the movie business? Was there a specific moment that made you think, that's what I want to do?
Nobody in my family or anybody that I knew had anything to do with movies or Hollywood. I'm from a small town called Highland, New York, mid-state New York. It used to be farm country, and apple orchards and mushroom farms and cattle. And now it's off the Hudson River, opposite Poughkeepsie. And it's now growing into more of a bedroom community for Poughkeepsie. But anyway, when I don't know. I fell in love with movies. You know, I mean, at first I fell in love with books. I was a reader. I'm talking when I was adolescent. And then I fell in high school or junior high school, I fell in love with movies. And I just went to see everything. But there was hardly anybody else that I knew in high school, certainly any of my parents' friends, that had any interest whatsoever. You know, so I just don't know. And then there was no way to get into movie, show business, whatever you want to call it, that I knew about, you know, because usually it's nepotism, let's be honest about
yeah.
it. And I had none of that. So I got myself to a school, a high school that had a drama coach, and the drama coach marked my enthusiasm, and he set me up with an interview and to be an apprentice at a summer stock theater called Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And the summer, the New Hope Playhouse, was pre-Broadway as a tryout on the circuit. So it had a very, very high level of professional productions and actors coming in. And I talked to a lot of people, and everybody said, be an actor. And that was because it was the only thing open. There was no way to get on to in the film, but people could see, you know, theater, you know, off Broadway, summer stock, winter stock. I did all of that. I toured. Anyway, from working as an apprentice at a summer stock theater, I learned about acting classes in New York. And the following summer, I was working as a clerk in a men's store, which happened to be owned by my parents. And I started going in on Saturday into New York City and taking acting classes at the Herbert Berghoff or HB Studios, as it was known then. It's sort of me and about 60 years worth of actors who've gone through the HB Studio on 21 Bank Street, the Village, the Greenwich Village, or whatever it was in New York City. And from that, I got an agent. And the agent got me when I started to head for theater after I got into Northwestern University Theater School in the first year. And I also picked up an agent in New York City as an actor, and I got a 7-year contract at Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the year was 1963, because that's where I was when JFK was assassinated, and I had to go to court to be able to sign a 7-year contract because I was under 21. I think I was 20, and I started to learn about the business, because I could wander around Warner Brothers and go into where they were doing the production. I could go into the editing rooms, the you know, listen to the sound, you know, and I started to learn about it technically, which I'd yeah. never had any access to before. And this was at the moment when the Hollywood studios were being crushed by the advent of television. And I appeared on such shows as the last season of 77 Sunset Strip, which was a huge, like 7 or 8 year television series. And the studios couldn't figure out how to get movies going and making money anymore. And I was let go from the contract, because at the yeah. same time, the television business was shifting, and nobody knew what was going on, but it was like the death of movies. I was at Warner Brothers when the the race course set from My Fair Lady was still standing on the biggest stage that Warner Brothers had. And it was a monstrous set and beyond impressive. I also wandered and played around on the Camelot sets from the Camelot Music, which were in the back lots of Warner Brothers. And people talked to me, and I got sort of an overall idea of the technical aspects of making film, but not enough. When I was released from contract and went back to New York, I got into doing television commercials, which the biggest conglomeration of creative people outside of Hollywood and the movies was in advertising.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, everybody shot commercials, was in them, or I was working both as an actor in front of the lens, but also I had a day job. I could job in working production for the commercials. So I always had a way to make 100, 125 a day. Okay, which in 1964 or 5 was very important. And somehow that I was still going out for acting, and I got a soap opera called The Time for Us and another one called Flame of the Wind, and I became a soap opera star. I was in my early 20s, I wasn't even mid. And I got mobbed at the Beatles concert at Shea Stadium in 1966. And it was because they were so frustrated, the audience, with not being able to get to the Beatles. Somebody recognized me from the soap and started screaming the name of the character. And all of a sudden, who then was my girlfriend, but became my wife, we were chased out of there, and the police saved us at Shea Stadium. Anyway, incredible stuff. And
wow.
Yeah, and then I was starting to get, I would fly out to L.A. to test for TV series. I'm still not interested in this, by the way. I mean, I'm still more interested in film. I mean, I never had the hunger that the true actors have. You know, I was more interested in how do you make the damn thing? And I got into the Actors Studio in L.A., and this was when Lee Strasberg was still teaching. It would be like 1966 or 67. And I was there through the early 70s. And they had a playwrights unit. And I started working there first as an actor. Then I came in and I started directing them. And they had a writers unit at the Actors Studio. And they were all screenwriters. But they were more than just aspiring. They were screenwriters who were working. There were people like Jim Bridges. It was, I can't remember the names now. Jim, I remember. But I started directing these one-act plays on the stage at the Actors Studio in DeLongpre in Hollywood. I think it's still there. Lou Antonio, great actor, is now running it. Haven't seen him in decades. And you can give me a scene, a dramatic scene. I mean, if it's well written, and I can figure out how to make it play. I can work with the actors and I can block it. And when I realized that I had that ability, that made me more anxious than anything else to direct. And I had headed for, if I could become a big enough commercial director, think Ridley Scott and Tony Scott, then maybe I could direct feature films. I had very, very little interest in television, except I was doing it as an actor to make money, like The Incredible Hulk. I guess start on that, and I can't. Anyway, the at that moment in time, that was just when Hollywood had been blown apart by Easy Rider. Okay, when Easy Rider exploded and broke through and got the youth audience, which at the time would have been youthful boomers, the Hollywood had a breakdown. They didn't know anymore what the audience would, what the youthful, this huge boomer generation were going to want to see after Easy Rider. And that threw the door open at that moment in time for original screenplays. okay? And they started buying them, and not only did they buy them, they made them. And most of them were not very good, not very successful, but a few were. And along with that, you had Spielberg breaking through. And, you know, and Brian De Palma and, you know, all those people. And I started writing screenplays. This was when you would go to a deli in L.A. and every waiter was an actor. You turned around 3 or 4 years later and every waiter or waitress was giving you a screenplay, an original screenplay, you know? And now, of course, it's just despair because nobody knows what the hell's going on with streaming.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I took me 10 years from the time I apprenticed in the summer of my 16th birthday. It took me more than 10 years. So by 19, I don't know, somewhere in there I got my first screenplay option, 1974. And that encouraged me enough that I was using acting and working commercial production to support the writing.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Okay. And I was a beat ahead of everybody else in that sense. A couple of years later, everybody was doing it, but at that point, it was just me, pretty much. And I started to get things optioned, and I got my first movie of the week, television movie, produced. I forget the year, but it was The Initiation of Sarah, 1977. That's only been remade, I think it's been remade 2 or 3 times. But it was a huge thing on television, and that gave me some visibility. And then I finally got my first movie produced, The Beast Within. Okay. And it was at United Artists, and the year was 1978 or 9. Okay. And so I thought I'd finally arrived. I had my first movie produced by a major, United Artists. And just as they were getting ready to release it, they went bankrupt with the destruction of Heaven's Gate.
Oh, yeah.
Which destroyed United Artists. And so The Beast Within is the last movie that UA released. It was a success and nobody noticed. Nobody paid any attention because all they were talking about was a dance, you know, Cimino movie. So what I'm saying is, I mean, I felt like putting a gun to my head. You know, I thought finally I would be able to work and get movies produced, and more important than anything else, make a living. And suddenly I was unemployed again because nobody knew, nobody cared. And I'm sitting around in total panic, despair, or whatever, you know, because at that point, the big 4-0 is coming up. And if you're a guy, and maybe girls, I don't know, but, you know, if you haven't figured out what you're trying to do, and if you're not making a living at it, and you're 40 years old, you're in deep trouble.
Yeah.
At least in America. I don't know about Great Britain, but, you know, in America. And I kept on writing originals, and I wrote a script, and it got sent to an Aussie named Richard Franklin, who was having a 19th nervous breakdown because he had finally gotten a chance from UA. I'm from UCLA. He was from USC. He finally had the chance to direct the movie, and he needed a writer, and the movie was Psycho 2.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. You were hired to pen a sequel to arguably the most iconic horror thriller of all time. Did you have any trepidation going into that?
Oh my God, yes. I was terrified. I figured it was the end of my career, which I had thought was just getting started, you know, but I didn't. I've been out of work for a year after my first movie comes out, and nobody wanted to do Psycho 2 because it was a career ender.
Yeah.
You cannot be in the, forget about even in the horror genre, but that's a classic movie. Psycho changed horror. Psycho is the beginning of what we consider modern day horror. Psycho was the first slasher film. Psycho created the first horror icon, Norman Bates, Anthony Perkins. I mean, it blew my mind. I was like 12 or 13 when I saw it. And I'd grown up in AIP and Hammer films. You know, Peter Vincent, from Fright Night. That's who Peter, who was named for, Vincent Price and Peter Cushing. Am I right? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted it because they knew they were going to get ripped by the critics. And I was so desperate. I said, yes, please give it to me. Please let me do it. You know? And Richard Franklin gave me the job because I'd written a script called The Crystal Tower, which has been bought and optioned and dropped and has been in production, pre-production. It's never gotten made, but it's a script that people don't seem to be able at the time. For about 20 years, people couldn't keep their hands off of it. And it did a lot for me as a writer, as a sample. I got to take a crack at writing Psycho 2. And I don't think I've ever worked harder on a script. To the best of my knowledge, that stands on the given circumstances from the original. Psycho 2, I mean. And Richard Franklin was absolutely brilliant. I mean, I went on to do Cloak and Dagger with him, and he wasn't so brilliant. But he was brilliant with Psycho 2, because he'd grown up with it like I had, with considering it, the best horror film ever made, opening. I don't think I even knew what editing bits and pieces of film were until I saw Psycho 2. I figured out when I saw the shower scene, I said, well, that's a lot of different setups in there to get that, you know?
Yeah.
I think they took 3 or 4 days to shoot it. That film, we didn't have Tony Perkins. Psycho 2 without Tony Perkins was like, forget it. It was like Jaws without Spielberg.
So
I had to write a script, and he'd already turned it down, Tony. That's something else. And Robert Block had written the book, the Psycho 2 book. But he killed Norman at the end of the first chapter. I don't know what Robert Block was thinking about. I did a symposium with him afterwards at the Writers Guild, and I should have asked him, but I didn't because he was too critical about the violence in Psycho 2. Uh-huh. Anyway, the Psycho 2 turned out to be an enormous hit, and none of us thought that was going to happen. So I had to write a script that was strong enough that Tony would say yes, and I was an actor. So I know about character arcs, and I thought I did a brilliant one there, actually, if he says so himself. But I mean, Norman Bates comes out of the institution at 22 years and he's desperately holding on to his sanity. Okay, yeah. And you, as you watch the movie, you feel sorry for him.
I was about to say this. There's a lot of ambiguity in it, that not to the point where you're not unsure. You're unsure. Not only are you unsure that he's guilty, but you're actively rooting for the guy. You don't want him to be. You don't want him to be reverting to how he was.
Right. Well, even more, you're doing what Hitchcock did. You're being forced to identify with a serial murderer. Okay?
Yeah.
I mean, and that makes the audience uncomfortable to begin with.
Yeah.
The cast, Vera Miles, Tilly, everybody was just excellent. Richard was spot on. We had blocked it out. We blocked out all of the scenes as I wrote. We watched or rewatched every movie that Hitchcock had ever made, including the silent movies, and we pulled out those moments where he had gone to what visual set pieces he had caught the suspense of it with the camera angles. I am right now preparing a book on Psycho 2. I guess you'd call it, I did it with the making of Child's Play, a visual memoir, but I'm going to do it with Psycho 2 because we've just had the 40th anniversary and it exploded. I had no idea that the fan base for Psycho 2 was as deep as it seems to have become. About 10 or 12 years ago, I went to the Blacklist, which is a writing group that's very prestigious. And all the horror directors were there. Everybody that you could, I sat next to Bredesen Ellis, James Wan was across the room, everybody. And they voted, this is 10 years ago, they voted Psycho 2 the best horror sequel ever.
Wow.
And I almost fell off my chair. You know, because nobody had mentioned it to me in 20 years. Now, in 1982, that summer, it was the second biggest grossing movie after the first sequel to Star Wars.
Yeah.
Which was unthinkable. When I started out doing that, Sony wanted to dump Psycho 2 as a cable movie. This is just when cable is beginning. If you look at it at the end, you'll see Oak Communications produced it. They originally had a cable deal on it. Universal. And so, in other words, we were doing a nowhere movie, Richard and I. We were the only ones who were impressed to death by the title. You know, don't you realize what you have here? No, they did not. Anyway, when Tony said he'd do it because he fell in love with the park, they put out a press release. And the reaction internationally, worldwide, was enormous. Norman Bates is Tony Perkins is coming back to do Norman Bates Psycho 2. The entire world wanted to see that. And Universal was like, uh-oh, we got a movie here. Now, we made that movie for something like $4,980,000. In other words, only one shot did we leave the back lot of Universal. It was the cheapest way you could possibly make the movie, you know?
Yeah.
And yet we were able to get the house built, the Psycho house. It wasn't there before that. My memory. No, there was nothing there. I have the photos now. I have my Polaroids. Richard has his photos. And Richard wrote a memoir. And he wrote it about Psycho 2. And it's fascinating. And I'm going to put his memories in. And then I'm going to do a paragraph with him and then a paragraph from me. So you're going to have the director and the writer from 40 years ago discussing the making of Psycho 2. So, I mean, so I'm excited about that. And I had never read his memoirs before, and I had no idea what the process was like from his perspective, from the director's perspective. And since I was deliriously happy with the movie, I'm only saying great things about Richard Franklin. But I mean, that was the beginning of my career, finally. I started writing in the late 60s, and you're talking 1982. So that was at least 12, 14 years to get where I finally had a movie that gave me a career as a screenwriter.
Yeah.
And Richard and I had, this is your audience isn't going to be interested in this, and we're taking up a lot of time. But Richard, I wrote, we went on and we made Cloak and Dagger. I wrote it for Richard. Richard directed it. Then I was writing Scream for Help, and Richard was going to do that, and he bailed on me halfway through. He got the link set up, and I was left alone with Michael Winner. And people seem to laugh a little bit about Michael Winner, but I found him absolutely charming. But he got through with my script on Scream for Help, and what he did was he cut all the dialogue that established why the people were the way they are and what they were trying to do and who they were. And before you were through, you had an acting piece with no acting in it, because he'd taken it all away from the actors. Uh-huh. And the movie couldn't. You could see it there in the cut, but he didn't cover it so it could be recut to bring the characters more alive. So that was sort of a disappointment. And after that, I felt like if anybody's going to screw up my next script, it's going to be me. you go like this, what are you doing now? That you can only get to where you feel like that after you've had some kind of success, at least some kind of confidence. And so I wrote on spec Fright Night. And we went out to try to sell that with me directing. And MGM tried to buy it away from me without me directing. And I kept turning everybody down. And yet I was successful enough as a screenwriter. I was getting all these major offers for movies. And a man called Guy McElwain, he was head of Columbia. They had an empty slot on their release schedule for that year, and they gave it to me. And I'm not quite sure how it happened, but I'll be forever grateful to Guy McElwain, who's no longer with us. Because he gave me the opportunity, and nobody paid attention to Fright Night. The reason they did it, you want to know how Hollywood works? They had an enormous success with Ghostbusters. And they were expecting to do a sequel. And they wanted to keep the effects team, which was then the best effects team in town. That was Richard Edlund. That was Randy Cook. Steve Johnson. There were so many of them, but I got that group for both the visuals, like the bat going off the balcony and changing, and you see the shadow, it changes, and Jerry goes off, changes into a bat in the shadow, and then comes back into life with a real bat coming at you. Yeah. That was Richard Edlund. So I had on my little movie that nobody was paying attention to, I had the best effects team in Hollywood, and they were brilliant. And that's why you have Amy's mouth. That's why you have the terrific Evil Ed. My gosh, it was like a dream, and nobody bothered me from the studio, because it was the cheapest movie that they had, and they didn't expect it to do any business. And it was mainly because they were going to keep Richard Edlund in place for the sequel of Ghostbusters, which they didn't do for years, as it turned out.
Yeah.
Anyway, Fright Night opens, and it does good business. It's not Jaws 3 or whatever, but I mean, it's very, very good, and gets a lot of note, because I think it sounds very conceited of me and egotistical, but I have a voice. I wasn't trying to redo the biggest success from last year. Yeah. I was trying to find my own voice, my own stories, and push ahead. And that was Fright Night, and my career took off.
Yeah. I mean, it's when you look at it, you assembled so not only behind the camera, but in front of the camera, you had some really great actors. I mean, you get the impression that it was kind of a... Just watching it, and I don't know if it's because I'm just a huge fan of it, it's one of my all-time favorites, but you get the impression it was fun to shoot. Is that correct?
Yes, it was huge fun. All we did was laugh all the time. I mean, I've got like 30 seconds of footage that Roddy shot as we were getting ready for the group photo, and you can feel it. You can feel how the cast was having a great time, because we had this extraordinary things that never happened again on our first film. I had 2 weeks of rehearsal time with the actors. So, I mean, I had that whole script. I had it on its feet, and you could look at it like a play, and it worked like a play. You could see it worked.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, but the actors had, because we had the time, chance to rehearse it and break it down scene by scene, all the actors were spot on. So when I started to shoot, I hardly had to say anything, because all the rehearsal had been done. And it's an opportunity that I never had again, because studios don't want to pay the actors for rehearsal.
I mean, you worked with Roddy McDowall before on Class of 84.
He'd been brilliant in Class of 84.
Yeah. I understand he wasn't the first choice for Peter Vincent. Is that right?
I wanted to have Vincent Price. Yes. And I reached out to him, and his health would not allow him to do Fright Night. I can't imagine it now, because after we were finished, Roddy had me over for dinner at his house with Vincent Price and his wife. And Vincent Price to me was like, like Freddy Krueger is now. I can't explain it. Among the dumbest things I did is I didn't take an autograph book around with me when I went out socially, you know, because I met so many people at that point during that time. And a lot of it was because of Roddy, because Roddy was so social and he'd have me over and I was meeting stars. I mean, one of the funniest evenings my wife and I ever had was with Walter Matthau and his wife at Roddy McDowell's. And Matthau was, we couldn't get through dinner for laughing. You know, so there are these wonderful things. And of course, you know, and there are also the tragedies. Anyway, is there anything you'd like to ask me soon? Because I should move on and really write a few pages.
That's not a problem. I was just going to ask, you went on to work on Child's Play again with Chris Sarandon. Obviously, you've got a good working relationship with him. What is it that makes him good as an actor to work with for you as a director?
Well, he's a brilliant actor, Chris Sarandon. The movie with Al Pacino, where he plays the trans, to Fright Night, and you get an idea of his range. I cannot say enough about Chris Sarandon. The other thing is, he has a very solid temperament. In other words, everybody on the stage could be losing their minds, and they were on Child's Play, and Chris will be there as solid as you could ask for, and he'll be right on with the scene every time, even as everybody else is committing suicide. So I can't speak highly enough. I mean, Child's Play was a huge undertaking. Please look at my book, Child's Play, A Visual Memoir. I mean, there were 11 and 12 puppeteers off screen for every shot on the doll. I mean, do you know what that, I mean, I can't, just trying to shoot the damn thing was extremely difficult, because I was trying to sustain the illusion that the doll was alive and moving without puppeteers. And once you were to one side or the other, you had 11, 12 puppeteers. I built the apartment for the third act. I built that about 4 or 5 feet off the stage floor. We had puppeteers under the stage. We drilled holes in the floor, ran the cable up that made Chucky work. I would shoot Chucky here, and the cables would be hidden behind them coming out of the floor. That's every shot, except where I used the little person, Ed Gale, who was terrific also. Anyway, and that When I wrote that script, I knew it was going to be a huge hit because I couldn't stop writing it to find out what happened next. I put the first iteration of the treatment of Child's Play in the visual memoir, along with the photos. It's all, so you can see where I started and what the initial vision was that I had and how much of it I got on the screen. And that's always sort of a dodgy question, but I think it's probably one. There's always a gap between a director's hopes and what they end up with in cutting it together. And one of the great challenges of cutting it together is making not just a few scenes work, but as many as you can.
Yeah.
And but Child's Play cut very, very, very well from the first preview. Whenever Chucky was on screen, the audience was with him. I mean, it was, I knew it when I wrote it. Chucky was a star, but you couldn't have called it Chucky because nobody knew who the hell Chucky was.
Yeah.
At least Child's Play as a title gave it some kind of insight into what the experience might be. Yeah. So, I mean, I've been very, very lucky. I also have my failures and all of that, but I'm not going to spend an hour talking about the things that I did wrong or the bridges that I burned that I shouldn't have or caring too much or not caring enough. And I don't know how the hell I've gotten this far. It's a mystery. It's all a mystery.
Yeah. So finally, I'd like to ask, what is next for you going forwards? Have you got any projects in the pipeline other than the Psycho 2 memoir that you'd like to talk about?
I am writing. I'm writing novels now and short stories. And I have all these, I'm writing all the, thank you, Fright Night Origins. You'll find it on, that has never stopped selling. This is it. Last Halloween in 2022, we introduced Fright Night Origins. We're coming out with the sequel, Fright Night Aftermath, hopefully this fall, certainly by Halloween.
Oh, fantastic.
The problem with writing original screenplays, as I know, is they buy them and then they say, well, you didn't really write them. We got it now. We own it. Yeah. And I mean, Hollywood, for all those aspiring people out there, get a good lawyer. Okay, get a good deal maker because it'll come back and bite you. So what I realized is the only way to get copyright was to write it first as a book. So what I'm doing is I'm writing novels of the stories that I did or wanted to do as screenplays, and I'm trying to get the novels out. But what I'm learning is it's taking me almost a year to write a novel. If I really had myself... If I had it worked out, I thought I could do two a year. But now I'm not so sure, but I wish the hell I could get up to two a year. So anyway, I've given you some truth to this. So your audience out there, if you're aspiring actors, writers, or directors, I hope you can learn and find encouragement from my experiences, along with a little wisdom. That's what I think anyway.
That's fantastic. I mean, if you ever need an extra as a character in your next movie or your next book that needs to meet a grisly fate, perhaps at the hands of Jerry Dandridge, I'm always available.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time and for the very, very good questions. You've made it very enjoyable. And to the audience out there, the only one way you're going to learn, and that's by doing it. And you don't have an excuse anymore not to shoot. Because you can do it on your iPhone now. God bless. Thank you very much. Good luck, everybody. Bye-bye. Bye.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Valspar Ultra starts at just $29.98 a gallon. So we've got you covered when your daughter wants to paint her room again after last year's masterpiece of a unicorn mural.
Dad, please.
Or when you realize that maybe you went too hard on the greige.
I miss color.
Or when you were sure you wanted a home gym, but your elliptical is currently hanging your laundry.
What about a home office?
Shop everything you need for your next phase with Valspar. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.